what we do to soil, we do to ourselves, because soil is the basis of everything. It filters all our water. It makes clean air. It has an effect on climate, on weather, and it has an effect on our own microbiome, the things that live in and on us. A lot of those things were born in soil, and our microbiome affects not only our health, but our mental health.
Hi, I'm Susie.
And I'm James.
You're listening to Soils for Life. In each episode, we bring you the stories of soil, the opportunities in the ground, and the challenges above it. We've all heard the saying, you are what you eat. But what we really should be saying is you are what you eat and the soil that it's grown in.
In this episode, we're looking at soil health and its relationship to the nutrient density of food.
But first, let's start with Courtney Young, who is a project manager for Soils for Life, but is also a farmer and grain miller who is prioritising nutrition, community and health.
I'm one half of Woodstock Flour. My husband Ian and I, we mill grain grown by my husband's family at Woodstock in Berrigan, New South Wales, and they've been certified organic since the early 90s. Ian's always been really proud of the grain that his parents have been able to grow organically. It's really high protein, really clean, high quality grain, and they used to mill it a little bit at home with a little kitchen mill. So Ian and I saw an opportunity to value add the grain that Ian's parents were growing and start selling it at farmers markets.
As well as processing the grain from her family farm, Courtney and Ian have recently brought their own farm just outside Rother Glen in Victoria. Courtney and Ian live in a wine growing region, which has really influenced their farming practices. You see, grape growing and wine production are deeply rooted in an understanding of soil health and how that impacts the flavour of the produce.
We've been really influenced by the wine industry, understanding how your unique soil profile is going to ultimately impact flavour. And so that really influences the way that you care for soil and the way that you care for those plants. So that's been really exciting to just hear from people about how they describe the flavour of our different grain. The feedback that we're getting is that it's really flavoursome. They've never considered that flour could have flavour.
Courtney attributes the unique flavour of her flour to healthy soil, but she believes that healthy soil could also provide nutritional benefits.
Our understanding is that if our soil biology is humming and our crops are resilient, then intuitively we feel like our grain will be nutritionally better off. It'll be really flavoursome. And I think that microbial diversity that we're supporting in the soils through organic inputs and our regenerative approach is translating to this microbially alive flour that's ultimately better for our guts and hopefully nutritiously dense as well.
Courtney is not the only one thinking about the linkages between soil and human health. Matthew Evans is a writer, chef, and farmer, and has become a passionate educator about food and soil.
When I first started writing about food and farmers in particular, I'd meet farmers and they'd go, oh, it's all about soil health. And they kept banging on about soil health. And I didn't really understand what they meant by healthy soil meant alive, living soil by definition. And then when I started growing food, I had all these questions about what is soil, what makes it good, what can make it less good, what's good for the things that I want to grow, whether it's grass to feed my animals or carrots to feed myself.
Soil fertility and soil health is the engine room that helps to grow healthy plants, either to feed us directly or to feed the livestock that we then eat.
98% of the food we eat is grown in soil. However, currently two-thirds of our agricultural soils are degraded, and soil nutrients essential to human health are declining.
Some of the stuff we're growing and eating today is not giving us the diversity of biochemicals that we probably should have in our diet that we've always had up until the last 100 or 150 years. And that's partly because the things that we're eating are becoming less nutrient dense. And by that, I mean per gram of broccoli today is generally going to have less of certain things in than a gram of broccoli did in 1950s. But also we've narrowed the range of what we eat down to sort of, you know, mostly it's 12 types of plant products and 5 types of animal protein that gives us 75% of our diet. Like we're eating a very limited range of stuff.
Robin Alders is the honorary professor with the Development Policy Centre at the Australian National University. And she says our nutritional scorecard doesn't look good.
When you look at the nutritional stats for the Australian population, we are in fact what you would describe as a malnourished nation. If you look at adults, for both men and women, well over half of our adult population are malnourished in the true meaning of that word. And not only are they overweight, often this is combined with having nutrient deficiencies. They're not getting all of those vitamins and minerals that they need for a healthy life. I truly believe that if farmers, producers, fisher folk, if they were seen as core components of the health system, that we'd actually have a lot less need to be going to the doctor.
It's really surprising to hear that the Australian population is malnourished, but in fact, the problem is global. Part of the reason people aren't getting what they need from their foods is because farmers are rewarded for how much they grow. Classic, quantity over quality.
Because we've focused on the production of commodities, the more you sell, the more you get paid. And so the selection pressure has been to grow crops, cereals, horticulture for things that grow quickly. So you see that the faster growing plant products and faster growing animal products usually have a higher percentage of energy and a lower percentage of key nutrients.
Robin says the way we farm is critical to human health, and it's not just the focus on quantity that's making foods less nutritionally available for us.
When people eat nutrients in whole foods, you get much better absorption, much better utilization, because it's not just about the nutrients. There are phytochemicals in some of the plants, these sorts of things that all contribute to absorption and to good health.
Phytochemicals are part of the plant's immune system and help protect the plant from viruses, bacteria, fungi, and parasites. Phytochemicals can offer humans some of that same protection and vary in concentration depending on farming practices.
I think it's vitally important we have to link the production side, which starts with soil and water, and that has to be linked through to managing the nutrient requirements of the population.
Matthew Evans has been looking at some of the emerging research in this field and has discovered some amazing links between soil, plant, animal, and human health.
Nutrition is a relatively new science. So for a long time, we concentrated on big things like calories and macronutrients like fat, protein, and carbohydrate as the things that we needed to focus on to feed people. And now we're saying, oh, actually, there are other things that are really important. The example I like to give to make us reframe soil and think of how important it is in terms of human health is a chemical called ergothionine. Now, ergothionine is only made by soil life. It's made by soil fungi and by soil microbes, mostly by fungi. And it's passed to plants and it gets into the plants in the same form that it was made by soil life. Now, once it's in the plant, and oats is where the research has generally been done on it, but it exists in lots of plants. Once it gets into the oats, say, if we eat a bowl of porridge, that ergothionine then passes into our body and it passes through the lining of our gut into our bloodstream in the same form it was made by soil fungi and by soil microbes. This is quite insane. But also, ergothionine can pass into our brains, right? So it passes through this membrane called the blood-brain barrier, really helpful to keep toxins out of our brains. But ergothionine, no problem, gets straight into our brains.
So after this long journey from the soil to our brain, how does ergothionine actually help us? What does it do?
Ergothionine, we know, is an antioxidant and anti-inflammatory chemical. So it actually has anti-aging and anti-dementia effects, right? This is measurable. Something made in soil has a direct and measurable impact on brain health. And this is just one chemical out of the 70,000 that we know exist in plants and can come from plants' interaction with soil. And so imagine what we don't know. So 98, 99% of what happens in soil, we don't really know what is there. We don't know what it does. But the one thing we do know about ergothionine is that if you plow the soil where the oats came from, you cut the fungal threads, the hyphae, that crisscross the soil. So you actually reduce the amount of ergothionine being made in the soil and you actually end up with less ergothioneine in the oats from ploughed land. So we know that if we plough the soil, we end up with less ergothioneine, and ergothioneine we know is probably beneficial for human health. So one tiny little change in the way we grow food, ploughing or not ploughing, and one chemical, and we can see there's an impact. So imagine all the other things that we do to soil that may be having an impact on stuff that we consume. And so I like to think of ergothioneine because it's an example of what we know, and also an example of, wow, what don't we know? And what are we maybe getting wrong that we'll have to watch out for in the future?
It's incredible that such a tiny component of food can potentially have such a profound impact on our health. Ergothioneine is one example, but the links between agriculture, soils, plants, animals, and human health are unbelievably complex.
Stefan van Vliet is the Assistant Professor of Nutrition at the Center for Human Nutrition Studies at Utah State University. He collaborates with farmers, ecologists, and agricultural scientists to study critical linkages between agricultural production methods and human health.
A lot of Stefan's research focuses on the nutritional benefits of meat and milk from animals grazing on diverse pastures and healthy soils.
And what we're doing now is doing large profile studies to try to figure out what is the role of soil health, what is the role of plant diversity in improving animal health.
Stefan is investigating how feeding livestock certain types of plants can impact their health and in turn our own health when we eat that animal or consume their milk. Just like with ergothioneine, Stefan is tracing the flow of nutrients from plants into animals and then into our bodies.
So if you have a parent compound in the plant, the animal metabolizes this, and then we get these metabolites into the meat and the milk, and then we get it into our bodies.
Metabolites are tiny molecules like proteins, vitamins, and amino acids that get created when food is turned into energy. Some we create, and others are created by plants and animals that we consume. In some cases, animals seem to perform a role of unlocking micronutrients in plants that would otherwise be unavailable to humans.
What is unique about an animal is that they consume vegetation you and I cannot consume. And perhaps the animal is consuming oftentimes plants that have some medicinal compounds, but we cannot obtain these because of the amount of cellulose that's in grasses. So some unique phytochemicals are being picked up, and the animal already metabolizes these for us. So this is really a further way of upcycling the phytochemical riches of our diet by having animals pick up these phytochemicals.
When animals are grazing things like wild onions or something, you see onion derives compounds such as chlorogenic acid or quercetin, gallic acid, which would also be actually garlic. You see that being enriched in the meat and maybe 10 times higher than the next sample that did not have those plants on its pasture. So it is actually those little nibbles on those colorful flowering plants that sometimes people even consider as weeds because it's not grass, is actually having a beneficial effect. Maybe a little bit of flowering clover and then other things that is chock full in these secondary metabolites. And this is especially in rangelands, is sort of herding these animals through it. They're probably being exposed to 150, 200 different plants.
We're often told to eat our carrots because you'll be able to see at night, or drink your milk to have healthy bones. But these are really simplified messages, and they're not quite right. We're used to hearing about macro and micronutrients and their importance, but I think a lot of people aren't used to hearing terms like metabolites and polyphenols.
Basically, metabolites are molecules generated through the metabolic process. Our bodies use them and create them. Things like proteins, vitamins, and amino acids. Polyphenols are compound molecules found in plants. They can act as antioxidants, and they can also be responsible for the flavor of foods. Think of things like coffee, onions, chocolate, and turmeric.
A huge list of over 70,000 compounds has been catalogued online, and if you want to, you can search by compound or by the foods they're found in. And we'll put a link to the website in the show notes.
These compounds have been known for a while, but they were called secondary metabolites. Secondary because for a long time we didn't really know what they did, and they were also not essential to life. But just because they're not essential to life doesn't mean they're not important. So primary metabolites would be things such as amino acids, vitamins and minerals, essential fatty acids. And then secondary metabolites, which probably constitutes 10,000, 100,000, 500,000 metabolites. We don't really know. We know it's a lot. But these things, they do impact our metabolism. A lot of them have antioxidant effects, anti-inflammatory effects. So they can have an impact on our health, and potentially they're at least associated with a decreased risk of cancer and heart disease. And there's also an interesting human nutrition study. This is done from a group out of Israel. They looked at the blood metabolism of humans. And what they found was that about 50% of what circulates in our blood is directly related to the foods that we eat. So I always jokingly say there's a half truth to your grandma saying you are what you eat. She was at least half right.
Grandma had a point. But now with machine learning, we're discovering more and more about the compounds in foods. But there's still a lot that we don't know.
So dark matter in terms of space is all the gaps between what we know. So it's the bit that science is going, there's something there, we just don't know what it is. Nutritional dark matter is a similar thing. So it's all the bits in between. There's a mob in Canada where they're actually trying to record how many biochemicals they can find in food and what they could get converted into once we digest them. Because we eat certain things and they get changed into other chemicals. And those things are generally good for gut health, for brain health, for communication in our body and bodily functions. And they've discovered there's probably like 70,000 different biochemicals that come from plants. And when you look at your nutritional panel on the back of your cornflakes, we've got like 12 things. And look, with your cornflakes, about 7 of those are added back in. For me, that's really 1950s looking at nutrition. There's all these other things that are in properly grown food and in fresh food that don't exist in processed food. We know that in garlic, there's 2,300 chemicals or something. That's a lot of chemicals in garlic, biochemicals. They're supposed to be there. And a couple of hundred of those at least have nutritional qualities. We know they have an impact on human health. Now, in what level, exactly what they do, that is yet to be elucidated by science. Science is going to find that out. But we should never forget that these things are quite important, even though they're tiny and fractional and maybe we can't name them or draw their chemical structure yet. But that doesn't mean that they're not important in human health.
Researchers are working to unravel the mysteries of nutritional dark matter. And some, like Stefan van Vliet, are going further to understand what sorts of farming practices create the best conditions for more of these critical but often overlooked compounds.
Most of the work that we do is at the nexus of agriculture and human health. So it's asking the fundamental question, do more sustainable or agroecological production practices also benefit human health? And that's really the million-dollar question.
Stefan says when it comes to grazing animals, one farming practice stands out above any other.
The key seems to be plant diversity. So if you're able to come up with a diverse pasture, get away from monocultures, you end up with meat that is typically richer in phytochemicals and that has more omega-3 fatty acids. On average, what we see is that it increases the phytochemicals 2 to 3-fold. So they're about 200 to 300% higher. So I think that's fairly considerable.
Soils for Life case studies show there's no silver bullet recipe to building soil health, but increasing diversity of plants and animals will almost always take the landscape in the right direction. It seems like one emerging theme from the research is that diversity in agricultural soils and diversity in diet leads to improved nutrition. For this reason, farmers like Courtney and Matthew are working to build more diversity on their farm.
We're experimenting with multi-species cropping, which has been really fun. It's another kind of logistical thing that we're trying to wrap our head around. Is there a way that we can grow wheat in a multi-species crop, and how do we get that grain sorted out? It's just a logistical challenge that we can definitely get around. But I think in terms of the soil, it's fantastic. And it means that the wheat that is grown in that multi-species crop is benefiting from having that diversity around it. And so hopefully accessing more nutrients and making microbial relationships because of that plant diversity in the crop. At the moment, we've got a summer cover of millet, sunflowers, radishes and oats in our summer cover, I think. And then with our wheat at the moment, we're trialing growing wheat with clover through the winter cereal growing period. And we're also direct drilling cereal rye into lucerne, which has been working quite well.
Matthew has implemented farming practices in his market garden that reflect all the soil research he has learnt writing his book called Soil. But he said the most important practice is not on the farm, but in his mind.
The most important practice that we adopted is reframing how we see soil. So we used to see soil as something that was fairly inert and something we had to work with, whatever our restrictions, you know, if it's clay or acidic or whatever, our sodic soils, that we would work within those limitations. What we started to do was say, hang on, soil's a living, breathing ecosystem, and there are functions that happen within soil through that ecosystem that are really beneficial for us as growers. So that was the framing, first thing. Then we changed the practices. So the first one, straight away, no dig. Because we had heavy compaction, we might loosen the soil a little bit further down and add organic matter a bit further down. But once we established a garden bed, we never dig it again. Then we went to, okay, how can we have diversity of crops, because every plant's giving something to soil, every plant's taking something from soil. So we tried to work out whether we could do intercropping, having different crops in the same row. And sometimes that didn't work, sometimes it worked. But then we were very clear about having diversity over time. So the thing that we'd started doing was cutting things off at ground level. So the brassicas, instead of taking the roots out, we would just cut them off at ground level and let all those roots rot into the soil. They're going to create cavities for all sorts of soil life and little air pockets, as well as organic matter under the soil. As growers, it's really good for us to consider is not just, are we growing the volume, but are we growing stuff with nutrient density? Are we capturing enough of the minerals that exist within our soil? And do occasionally we need to add things? Do we need to add some rock dust, some crushed volcanic rock that has more of these minerals in there in tiny amounts that will then get into our crops? But biology and soil life is one of those ways of doing that. And it doesn't have to add much to the expense. There are people working with tiny fractions of worm juice put on seeds before they go out to give a more biologically active start to the plant. There are people using fungal sprays on wheat to produce a better tasting wheat. So they're not necessarily super expensive.
Stefan's research shows grazing livestock on diverse pastures results in higher amounts of phytochemicals in meat and milk compared to grazing monoculture pastures, while phytochemicals are further reduced in meat or milk of grain-fed animals.
Think of it like this. If, as a human, we'd go to the cafeteria and there were only three foods that we could select from, we're probably much better able to nourish ourselves if we had 40 foods to select from.
Stefan also says that having a diversity of animals is important. Running sheep, cattle, and goats together with different grazing habits has benefits to us and the landscape. He also says for animals to be healthy, they need to get their daily exercise.
An animal out on pasture kind of looks like an athlete metabolically. So you see the mitochondria upregulated, you have better glucose control, less oxidative stress, which is exactly what we saw in humans that were physically active and were eating healthy diets. And then maybe an animal in confinement looks more like what you think of a couch potato. So it's really interesting that what we do to our animals, we might do to ourselves.
And no one wants to be a couch potato. Some farmers have a diverse plant mix and others increase their animal diversity. But when you combine plant and animal diversity, you get an explosion of biodiversity.
Diversity is a key theme across our case studies and in the work we're doing with farmers. Farmers are telling us that it improves their landscape function, their soil health, and their businesses.
I can't imagine an organic cropping system without stock for us. We've got a small mob of sheep which we're managing holistically. The sheep are important for managing stubbles, particularly on the family farm. But our idea with the sheep is that we can manage weeds and we can get that nutrient cycling happening by increasing the density of our mob. They're merino cross Hampshire Downs and they're really delicious. We've had lots of really lovely feedback. I'm sure part of it is processing and freshness, but I think we really look after those animals and we try to give them a really biodiverse diet. I just think you'd be mad to not sow a diverse pasture. You can see the animals picking and choosing what they want to eat. We've noticed really nice marbling in our meat the more that our pastures have progressed. It could be partly due to genetics and like we're selecting from our mob, but I'd like to think it's because of our management and the diversity that we've been able to establish in the pastures.
The sheep provide fertilizer to the soil, increasing the available nutrients, and provide a secondary income, building resilience into Courtney's business. Matthew says it's not just humans that benefit from more diversity in agricultural soils and from regenerative farming practices. There's plenty of evidence showing a benefit for animals' health too. Matthew's market garden is called Fat Pig Farm for a reason.
We tend to find that the more diverse our grazing animals' diet, the more interesting their meat is, which is not surprising. Most of the research that we've looked at into this is pretty clear. You know, you can have 3, 4, 5 times the more omega-3s in your grass-fed dairy and meat than you can in stuff that's grain-fed. So we know that there's a big difference in that sense in terms of diet. We certainly find with our pigs, we have to buy a grain mix to keep their protein levels up. But if I can be feeding them whey and skimmed milk and apple pulp and vegetable waste, the meat is completely different than if we only fed them the pellets or the grain mix. We cycle nutrients within the farm, taking vegetable waste and the things that humans won't eat and putting it through a pig. The pigs are moved around every week, so they're fertilizing the paddocks. It also seems like a health thing. The animals, if they want, can generally browse on stuff that seems to have therapeutic effect. A lot of them are eating willow at the moment if they want it, which has apparently a salicylic acid. So it's got a sort of a nice health benefit for them apparently. But from our perspective, the variety of diet equals more complex, interesting flavours in the meat that we eat. The best way we've got to tell nutrient density is on the front of your face. It's your nose. Because every time you eat, you can pick up to a trillion different smells. And those smells represent some of those biochemicals in the food. Generally, if it tastes more complex, more interesting, more delicious, then the science tends to show, and I certainly believe, that it's more nutrient dense. And for me, that's a reflection of soil health.
Many farmers instinctively feel that their produce is more nutrient dense. All those nutrients and beneficial compounds do even more than make us healthy. I know as a child in my mother's garden, we would pile on the compost and liquid manure from our horses, chickens and worms. And we were rewarded with the most mouth-watering berries. It really did seem that healthy soils made the most delicious foods. And Stefan says this is backed by science.
These phytochemicals that we're talking about, they're actually flavor compounds and aroma compounds. So I look at this from a human nutrition standpoint and think of these things as compounds that can improve our health. But someone in gastronomy will look at these compounds and say, well, these are aromas and flavor constituents. And it's interesting because this is how we got into researching this, because in the 2000s, the French and Italians had done a lot of work on these phytochemicals, and they were not so much interested from the health perspective. They were interested in how can we create the best tasting cheeses and how can we get these phytochemicals into the cheeses by grazing animals through these alpine landscapes or in Sardinia through the mountains. How can we provide these animals access to a salad bar and pick up these phytochemicals so we can create really good tasting cheeses? And they were studying phytochemicals and terpenes, which are aromatic compounds.
From scientific data to taste bud analysis, it all makes sense that diverse and complex ecosystems make more nutritionally dense foods. It's a complex tangle of interconnections between macronutrients, micronutrients, soil, plants, and animals and humans. And when we think about the connections between them, all our guests keep coming back to this one concept.
So there's this idea of one health, that soil health, plant health, animal health, human health, global health, they're all very much intertwined. And the more we look into it, it just does seem to be that way. If we're stripping stuff out of soil, are we taking it out of ourselves, which is going to have consequences which we are yet to discover?
The term One Health came about after the outbreak of avian influenza, or bird flu as it's commonly known, where the link between human health, animal health, and environmental health was laid bare.
One Health is really a new term for a very old concept, an indigenous philosophy, their concept of dream time. Their definition of health, that even the health of the individual, is inseparable from the health of the environment, from the health of community. Many of Indigenous communities around the world have understood this, and they've understood this from thousands of years of interacting and prospering in their own landscapes.
Unfortunately, our food systems, from the paddock to the plate and everything in between, has not been designed with the One Health concept in mind. But with cooperation between organisations, this could change.
There is research that's showing that the nutrient profiles of both the crops and the animals that are coming off those systems have a better nutrient density. What we don't have here in Australia is good data to show the difference between systems. One of the key things that I think is very important for our Department of Ag, and eventually when we do start having more in-depth discussions with public health nutritionists, is really having data systems that record the production system used on particular farms.
This would enable us to differentiate between products from farms managed regeneratively and products from farms managed in a typical way, and therefore allow researchers to compare the nutritional value of these products from different systems.
So we have to start having more data from more farms so that they're able to do these comparisons. And then our public health nutritionist colleagues need the money to do the testing on the products that are coming off the food, so that we've got data on what Australia can sustainably produce, what's got that optimal mix of nutrients that's going to keep us healthy, the animals and the plants healthy, and the environment healthy. The problem is not the methodology. The methodology is known. It's about having the funding to facilitate that research. So if we look at really the last 50, 60 years of nutrition research, in many cases, government has not adequately funded this. It's tended to be funded by the food industry, and so they fund the research they're interested in.
Another challenge is actually measuring the presence of all those critical micronutrients. In order to measure and prove the existence of these healthy compounds in regeneratively produced food, Stefan has turned to technology. Mass spec is short for mass spectrometer, and it is a device for identifying the kinds of particles present in any given substance. It's often used for drug testing, pesticide residue analysis, and carbon dating.
And what mass spec can do is it can look at the mass of specific compounds very directly. Individual compounds have unique masses, and you can measure these very precisely. And that's the way that we can then say, oh, we measure carrot A or carrot B, and carrot A has twice as much carotenoid as carrot B. So there's ways of measuring it, but at the moment, yes, it's very laborious and not something you would do at the grocery store.
Emerging technologies are making it easier to test for micronutrients, and this could help accelerate research to better understand the links between soil health, farming practices, and human nutrition.
We need signals that go from the consumer through the food processors to the farmers. And at the moment, it's difficult for consumers to provide those signals because they don't have enough information to choose a nutrient-dense food.
The more we know, the better chances we have of making good decisions, which is good news for the plants and the animals that are also dependent on that soil. And I guess that includes us. So it's looking at nutrient density for all of those resources that you're using, water, soil, key nutrients. What are you getting in return? And is that the most efficient package to understand how best to keep the soil as healthy for as long as possible? And in an increasingly complex world where we have to justify all of our emissions, I think linking that with greenhouse gas emissions from the different production systems, looking at water usage and the ability to sequester carbon within these systems.
In the near future, as the tech advances, we could have QR codes on food packaging, providing information on provenance and farming methods with detailed nutritional data that could be linked to an app with your personal nutritional requirements, and maybe even a climate-friendly score. And this all doesn't seem that far away. Courtney has found a market for her produce with people who are looking for food grown in healthy ecological systems.
There's definitely market demand for grown produce based on the assumption that it is healthier. which I find really exciting. We've got lots of people contacting us with a lot of health problems. Gluten intolerances is obviously a big one. And so they're seeking us out because they know that we're trying to farm in a more regenerative fashion. They're also seeking us out because they know that there'll be no chemical residues on our product. And then people with gluten intolerances, they're able to tolerate our grain. And maybe because our grain isn't pumped up with synthetic nitrogen, maybe the gluten is a bit softer and easier to digest. They're not necessarily asking about the nutrient density. They're more concerned about the practices. There's a lot of concern around glyphosate herbicides, around fungicides. There's a lot of concerns on the health impacts of those. And then on the commercial end, our bakeries are really happy with how the flour is fermenting in their products and the flavor that's coming across. They also come to us for our flour because they know that the flour works really well in sourdough. And I put that down to that microbiome of the seed that we're really trying to foster and to allow to thrive. It's also partly due to processing. We only sell stone ground whole grain flour that's really fresh.
Farmers like Courtney and Matthew are keen to do more, but there's so much more we could be doing to recognise the potential value of regenerative practices for human health.
Like many farmers, capital costs are still a key constraint for Courtney, and she feels like the systems that surround farming need to shift so that more farmers can make the transition towards practices that produce more nutrient density.
I think if we had access to more capital, we would be more diligent with our testing, so our soil and food testing, but then also in terms of infrastructure on the farm, we need to invest in a new disc seeder so that we can be experimenting with some more no-kill cropping so that we can reduce our tillage. We're really keen to see how far we can go with no-kill cropping, so direct seeding a cereal into maybe a roller crimped cover crop.
But like many farmers, Courtney says what she really needs is time.
We want to open up more time so that we can focus on more biofertilizers and making our own biological amendments so that we can really nurture the indigenous microbes that are here, so that we can foster that plant microbiome soil relationship and ultimately get more of those micronutrients from the soil. I'm hearing from a lot of farmers, and that I'm realizing myself, there is no silver bullet. There's so many different factors at play when you're trying to regenerate soils, when you're trying to create healthy food. Even just interpreting a soils test is really difficult. And then understanding how that soil test relates to the soil biology, and then how all of that then relates with your environment and your practices and the crop that you're trying to produce. I know so many really amazing grain growers that are doing incredible things. They're producing this high quality grain, and then they're only getting a couple of $100 per ton for that grain, despite all the energy and effort that's going into that. The way that our current system is set up, it's really not favoring those farmers who are putting in the work and doing the right thing for our food and for our soils. And so they're just surviving. If we want our farmers to be paid appropriately for the produce, we need to be thinking about how our food systems are structured and who are they servicing and how resilient are they.
Farmers need to be paid well for producing nutrient dense. We need information, farmers' trust, to help them transition towards systems support soil health and produce better food. And they need tools to measure the quality of the food they're producing so they can adjust systems. Critically, consumers also need information to choose the best food for them.
This is going to be one of these challenges that comes up in the next 10 years for farmers, because they've always been paid on yield. So it's how many kilos you can grow. That's how you get paid. So farmers have a choice to grow more, sell more. That's it. They don't usually set the price. And so what they've done is just gone for big, not better. We need to move the dial a bit and say, how do we pay farmers for nutrient density? It'd be nice to have some kind of simple thing for people to say, oh, this has got 88% of what we would expect in broccoli. Or this one over here, it's much cheaper, but it's only got 40% of what we would expect in broccoli. Maybe I'll buy the one that's more nutrient dense and support the farmer that's looking after the soil better. That's my hope. That's my dream. There's a lot of things that might work against that, but I think we've never had the technology till now. This is the possibility as we go into the future.
What's exciting for me is to see that increasing sectors of the scientific community are really taking a systems approach. We have agriculturalists, many of whom active in the regenerative ag space, that know that things have to change and that we do need to do things better and look after the health of our soil. We need to understand those natural cycles and to work with them. And I think as we bring the different disciplines together, we have to find ways to get the government and private sector to also work as a network. And I think one of the key things that will help to drive change is the move to circular economics. So if there's anyone from Treasury listening now, anyone from planning and finance, if you're able to get your sectors to work together more effectively, it's going to be easier for you to manage your budget, because if people are eating better, they're going to be healthier.
And Courtney says, like so many other things, it comes back to community.
I care about nutrition because I care about my community being healthy. For so long, we've viewed nutrition in this really singular lens, but it's a real systemic can of worms, and we need to be looking at it holistically. We need to be thinking about how we can produce food in a way that regenerates soils, and how we can process that food in a way that retains those nutrients, and how we can make sure our communities can access that food so that it's fresh and still holding on to those nutrients. So I think we've always really tried to approach our farm from a kind of community wider landscape perspective.
Matthew is a strong advocate for communities connecting growers and eaters, and says better, healthier tasting food is the way to get people to care about soil health and reconnect to farming.
We have a little restaurant on our farm. For the last 7 years, we've been serving people food that we grow. And we get people who aren't used to eating many vegetables, to be honest. And they didn't know Brussels sprouts could taste like that. And we didn't do anything here in the kitchen. We did it all in the garden. In our garden, what we've found over time, the soil has got better as the organic matter has tripled. It's gone from about 4% and a bit up to 12% in our market garden, and it's just cycling. And what we're finding is our carrots taste better every year. When I have to go somewhere and buy vegetables from a supermarket, I find them really lacking. They don't taste as good and they don't fill me with much joy. And I can see why people have struggled to eat many of them. As a farmer, that's one of those areas I'm like, well, you know, how do we get this food in front of people and get people to love it and want it and eat it? This lovely connection between soil health and human health, but also human pleasure, is this really lovely line that would be nice if we could connect those dots a little bit better more generally in society.
This podcast has been produced by the Grow Love Project in collaboration with Soils for Life. We'd like to thank all the guests for their time and insights. For more information, check out the links in the show notes. Sign up to the Soils for Life newsletter and be sure to subscribe to the podcast. Thanks for listening.